Chat with Traders, episode 23.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
Hey there, what's up? Welcome back to episode number 23 of the Chat with Traders podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Fifield, and thanks so much for tuning in. Now this week, I had a very interesting discussion. I was fortunate enough to speak with David Bush, an extraordinary seasoned trader with 20 years experience in financial markets. David comes from a non-traditional background, and what I mean by this is he has no formal education in the field of finance. In fact, he is a music graduate and performed as a professional musician for many years. But as you're about to hear, David changed paths during his 20s to become a trader. After overcoming the initial challenges that all new market participants endure, David did well for himself as a discretionary trader for many years. But with an urge to optimize his trading approach, he gradually transitioned into a quantitative trader and went searching for new ways to exploit opportunities within the market. From there, David has gone on to take out the number one spot of Battlefin's Sharpe Ratio Shootout, an international quantitative finance tournament with over 3,000 competitors. During our interview, David brings a really insightful take to topics such as the transition from discretionary to quantitative trading, how to eliminate a single point of failure by trading multiple systems, and how the Monte Carlo tool can teach you a lot about how robust your strategy really is. And I must give a special mention to Zach Hurwitz, who was the guest on episode 11, for making the intro to Dave. So thanks a lot, Zach. I appreciate it, man. All right, guys. I'm Aaron Fifield, host of Chat with Traders. Here is this week's guest, David Bush. Dave, what's up, man? How you going?
Doing great. Good to speak with you, Aaron.
Likewise. Thanks so much for coming on the show. It's great to be speaking with you, the Battlefin champion.
A Battlefin champion. there are a few at this point, but yeah, I was probably number four. That might be right. I'm not sure about that, but yeah, it's certainly that's been a great relationship and fun experience.
Nice. What was the category you took out then?
Let's see. If I recollect correctly, there were, I think in the email, there were 3,200 applicants from 41 countries, or a bit more than that applicants-wise. But they chose, I think it was 9 or 10 strategies in three different divisions. I couldn't speak to everything about the divisions, but one division had an audited track record, one simply a live track record, one might have been just back tested results, and I had a live track record and verified or audited results. So I was in that so-called elite category, and I think the strategies also, if I remember correctly, were across broad asset classes. So it was not like equities were in one bucket and futures were in another, and so on and so forth. I think I'm right about that. At any rate, they had a proprietary formula and, which took volatility into account. So in other words, it wasn't just a return based type of, formula, which, is flawed in the sense of one can just juice a strategy for a tournament or something like that. So that I don't believe that was anyone's approach anyways, but that was the gist of it at a high level.
Yeah, very cool. Well done. So let's get this started by giving us sort of a bit of an intro about yourself. So take us back to where it all began for you and tell us how you discovered trading and what were you doing at the time?
Yeah, that's a lot to talk about there, and I'm sure everyone's story is probably different in the details, but similar in the sense of a lot to talk about at the early stages. What I was doing at the time was I was a professional musician. I had been for a number of years. I got started playing very early. you know, in grammar school, I guess. I took to it very, very deeply. You know, after a couple of years, I wouldn't say I was bitten by music bug immediately, but after a couple of years, I started playing drum set. That's ultimately what I played professionally. And that is just, it just took over, you know. And as I look back, you know, music and markets are both pattern driven. They're both cyclical. One has to tune in. You know, you have to tune in as a musician to those around you. Literally, if you're playing a pitch instrument, you know, to pitch, obviously drums to groove and tempo, dynamic, you know, on and on. There are many layers that are happening simultaneously. Markets are very similar, and they both are, you know, they both have that behavioral component. You know, markets are certainly not the same in terms of investor sentiment behavior from, you know, year to year, day to day, whatever. So anyways, to answer your question about, you know, how we got into this, you know, I'm working essentially, you know, in the evenings, you know, and at night, and occasionally obviously rehearsing during the day. But days were, you know, largely free. And, you know, I don't remember the exact initial trigger, but I believe it was watching. I believe I was at my father's house, and he might have had CNBC on, you know, in the very early days. This would have been 1994, early 1995, but this probably would have been 1994 before I started trading, which was in 95. And I remember probably on CNBC, possibly Bloomberg, seeing a piece or, you know, some kind of interview, and whoever was being interviewed talked about the market. He said, you know, valuation can change overnight. You know, I mean, yesterday's close can be dramatically different from tomorrow's open based on just market crowd sentiment, you know, however you want to phrase it. And for whatever reason, that just fascinated me. And plus the ticker, you know, the scrolling ticker, which is not something that I use, you know, at all, unless it's some kind of watch capacity, you know, which is uncommon for me. You know, that fascinated me. I knew that there were patterns in there. Obviously, you could just visually see some patterns. And then also, you know, obviously I knew there was opportunity in there. And, you know, I was, you know, I'm not shy about saying after all my training, I was a very, very good musician. I played, you know, at a high level and so on. But, you know, it wasn't the most fruitful, you know, career monetarily, at least, you know, in my years, you know, as a professional. So, you know, so there was a perfect opportunity to look at something new and, you know, see if I was really interested and see if I could do it. You know, so that was the genesis of the idea. You know, from there, it was really starting to pick out some books, go to the bookstore. There were a lot of futures books at that time, which is interesting because there are not as many when I go to the bookstore now, you know, physical bricks and mortar bookstore. But there were just tons of you know, Larry Williams books and so forth. But, you know, ultimately it was stock that I started trading. And, you know, it was actually you know, picking up Investors Daily and seeing charts and going, oh, okay, charts, these are interesting, you know, and that led me into, you know, investigating, you know, what technical analysis was. So that really is, I probably missed some part of your question there, Aaron, but, you know, that was really the very, you know, the very early stage.
Yeah, that's excellent. So, I mean, I obviously wasn't trading around that point in time, so I believe this was before electronic trading sort of really came in. So talk to us about how you were maybe receiving data at the time and analyzing the market and sort of placing trades. I believe it sort of involved a fax machine of some sort.
Right. And it's funny now to me anyways. It did. The fax machine was later on. That was an incredible upgrade, actually. You know, what it first began was the newspaper, literally. Reading stock tables, Barron's Investors Business Daily. But I quickly learned through Investors Business Daily that they had a service at the time, and they probably still have it now electronically. But back then, to me, it was an amazing service because it was called Daily Graphs, and you could get this graph book sent produced after Friday's close. So, you know, after 4 p.m. New York time, probably had to wait till that, you know, even after that to get official closes and so forth. But that would arrive at my house. And, you know, I lived in New York City for a long time, but my girlfriend and, you know, then girlfriend, now wife, and I had moved up to the Catskills. So we were north of the city and, you know, kind of remote in a sense. This chart book would show up on Saturday mornings with all the latest charts through Friday's close. And that was, you know, that was just awesome to me because, you know, the FedEx or whatever it was, truck would drive in and I'd get this chart book. I'd rip open the envelope and, you know, I knew that that weekend and for the next week I'd be staring at that, you know, and I would mentally update things as to, you know, throughout the day or throughout the week rather, you know, this stock had gone up, this had gone down, whatever. But I mean, it was very crude. And yet, it was definitely formative. And my first trade was based off of, you know, based off of what I knew to look for, which was limited, but, was based off of chart pattern. And I think it was that very first trade. I'm almost sure, which was Xilogix, XLGX. I'm almost sure that without digging through ancient trade confirms, that was my first trade, and I got woken up. I didn't, you know, I didn't have data coming in. I did not have any kind of you know, active real time anything. So I got woken up by my broker, and he was a full service broker, and I probably placed about two trades with him when I realized the cost of them, which was, I think, maybe a couple hundred bucks a trade back then. I realized that was insane. But he woke me up one morning, actually, pretty early before the market was opening. And he said, "Hey, you know, it's Charlie. You're making money in your sleep, you know." And I don't know whether I was asleep or whether I just was not quite up and running, but I do remember answering the phone and listening to this and going, "What the heck is he talking about?" And that stock had been taken over, you know, 2 or 3 weeks after I had placed the trade. So that was, in hindsight, probably like the worst thing that could happen to me, because here you've got this process that looks incredibly easy, right? You know, you just get a chart book, you pick what you think's the best. It gets taken over for, you know, whatever percent gain it was, probably, you know, somewhere between 30, 40, 50, 60. I don't think it was as high as 60, but it was probably in the 40 or 50% gap up range, something like that. At any rate, you know, above my entry. And, you know, that was the first trade. And, you know, from there it was a hard slog, you know, basically, you know, speeding up my path a little bit. You know, I did get trading quotes. That was the beginning of some pain for me, because while I was looking at charts initially, I got quotes, but the quotes didn't have charts, and the quotes came through cable. So you had to have a cable connection. They came into a little box that, God forbid, if it ever got unplugged, it took about 2 hours to reload that box, the OS. But anyways, I got quotes. So now I had quotes, no charts, and I started, you know, trying to trade based on that. You know, I had some success, some obviously some losses, but it was very. I was as people will say when they're new at something powerful. You know, I was most dangerous to myself. You know, I had a loaded weapon, and I was. You know, constantly, you know, it was constantly pointed at myself. You know, I ultimately placed a lot of trades, went away to play music for a couple weeks, and the market had a very normal pullback. This was now in 1996, and I basically, you know, not watching charts, just working off of quotes. You know, I lost a lot of money. In fact, the screen every morning, I would just look at the screen. And, of course, you know, in a pullback that's broad, you know, the screen is essentially red. There might be a few defensive names that are green, you know, at the top if you have it sorted that way. But basically, you know, day after day, the market was just pulling back broadly, everything highly correlated, my stocks all going down. And eventually, you know, I was getting very afraid. And you have to remember, I knew almost nothing. I was completely self-taught. I had some success, but this was my first real pain moment. And, you know, I said, if this happens, you know, if the market is down again tomorrow, I'm going to sell it. I can't take it. And I remember that next day, it opened, you know, timidly, maybe a little bit higher. And then the market just sold off, and it was an absolute knife twist, bottom. You know, I sold out of everything, market reversed, ended up positively. That was, you know, the bottom for probably months, actually. You know, I mean, it was the classic, reactionary trader psychology. And, that was when that was my gut check moment, where it was, okay, you know, am I going to really do this? Am I serious about this? Because clearly I'm not equipped to do this properly. And, you know, in terms of education, in terms of equipment, anything. And, you know, I'm not one to give up easily. So I just buckled down, and that's when I started really reading. That's when I started, you know, I had an aha moment of, you know, every trade needs a plan. Every, you know, risk needs to be defined. I mean, really, it's so basic. However, that was the beginning of really becoming a trader, was, you know, that first, you know, large, painful loss, you know, account drawdown, and you know, and then going, all right, what am I going to do about this?
Okay. So from that point, where were you learning from? Did you land a mentor, or did you continue to teach yourself, like through books and study, et cetera?
Yeah, up to that point, it had been exactly that. But then it comes the fax machine. You know, I started subscribing to a couple of newsletters. This was, you know, again, this was still before email, or, you know, at least any, you know, widely spread email. I'm sure some governments were in some early, you know, had some early iterations and so forth. But, you know, so I got a fax service. I got a fax machine, and I started subscribing to some fax services, and they were just daily trading sheets. You know, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. Here's my stop. Here's our target. You know, here's the kind of order. Very basic. So I subscribed to a couple of those, or at least trialed them. I subscribed to one of them. And, you know, after a couple months, I called the guys up. I said, hey, you know, I'm not that far from you. Can I come in? I'm a subscriber. Can I just see your operation? And, you know, they said, all right, you know, come on in. And it was a couple guys with a secretary, a money management business, but also that was just making a little, you know, small foray into education. And essentially it became no one ever used the word internship, but it essentially became an internship where I was able to just, you know, help them around the office, do this and that odd, you know, job, whatever. And meanwhile, I was often behind them, listening to them talk about the markets, listening to them look for opportunity, place trades, whatever. And I started to, obviously, I picked that up.
Okay, excellent. So give us a bit of an overview of sort of your trading approach and sort of the method that you've adapted today and sort of how you navigate the markets.
Sure. It's certainly evolved. You know, my early trading, once I had education, once I had really a couple mentors clarifying things for me, showing me subtleties of patterns, showing me, you know, how to get a deeper insight into a daily chart, for instance, by looking intraday and lowering risk and so on. It really was discretionary technical trading, trading primarily on a swing time frame. So looking for, you know, that kind of 2 or 3 day to 1 or 2 week type of trades. So working typically off, you know, daily chart, but looking at various time frames, and trading larger concentrated positions. You know, they might be, you know, 20, 30, sometimes greater percent of the account, you know, which is something I don't do anything resembling that now. But at the time, you know, that is how I started. Flash to the, you know, present day, which is 20 years later, not quite to the month, but in a few months it will be. And I have a couple strategies. I still play some discretionary trades, certainly, but my primary activity is quantitative, and I have a flagship strategy, one that's been live for over 4 years, you know, and has an extensive backtest with, you know, survivorship bias-free data and much more that I could speak to. But that is, that's my primary strategy. That is very similar in a sense to my early trading style, but it's quantified. All the positions are typically small. There are no concentrated positions. Nothing ever over 10%, and in fact the max is lower than that, and the typical position is much lower than that. So it really, I see the evolution of my trading as, you know, managing a trade or a few trades at a time to managing strategies. The strategy I just spoke to, another strategy that is in the final stages of development is also quantitative, but it's very different. It's a machine learning based strategy. It will be up to, this remains to be seen, but somewhere between 30 and 50 most likely strategies or systems rather, all running together as a meta system, you know, under one strategy. So that's yet another thing, and that'll be primarily intraday. But bottom line, now I'm really the manager of strategies. The trades themselves are less significant. Obviously, they're important that overall they work, but it's really making sure that the risk controls are in place and are working, that the live trading is in line with the back test. There's lots of ways to back test poorly. So, you know, that's probably more than you asked for, Aaron, but that's, you know, the kind of the quick evolution of my trading.
Yeah, that's excellent. And I want to sort of get into that a little bit deeper. But before we do, if you were to give sort of a discretionary trader an overview of quantitative trading, how would you actually sort of explain this? Just if we can be clear on this before we sort of get too much deeper into it.
Sure. Well, it's a great question, and deserves probably a compact, elegant answer. And let me try to do that in a second. This might be helpful because I was that discretionary trader, and why did I get into quantitative trading? It's because I had this question, which was, I'm in a trade, right? And I've entered this trade as a discretionary trader. What does that mean? It means that I'm using charts. I'm trading on principles, right? I'm trading this trade because volatility contracted. There were narrow range bars. The trend was clear, whether up or down. On and on and on. Bunch of principles that formed enough of a case, they built enough of a case to justify this trade. But now I'm in it, and I know my risk and so forth, and, I'm hip to proper position sizing, of which there are many approaches. But what I never knew the answer to was, what I was always asking was, what's the optimal exit? Like, when should I get out? Is it when I feel like getting out, so there's so many behavioral biases that work against the discretionary trader or your average discretionary trader. Your fantastic discretionary trader can overcome all or most of these biases of not selling too soon and not holding on to the loser, the disposition effect, and all these kinds of things. But bottom line, I knew that there had to be, based on my approach, if I made those, conditions, if I made them rules, there must be an optimal exit. Even if the exit evolved later on or was a little bit different in the past, right at this moment, there probably was an optimal exit and I didn't know it. So that was the germ or the seed that was planted that, that I carried for a while without doing anything about it. But ultimately, ultimately I did make the move into finally, getting over my fear of learning to code and diving in. So I certainly can, you know, speak to any of that more. But in terms of, you know, the benefits, you know, of quantitative trading, one can really aim to be optimal or at least near optimal. That's how I think of it, rather than trading suboptimal. I mean, whatever area of business you look at, you know, or you know, let's take you know, conservation for example. You know, let's say you know, a company is trying to, you know, shave expenses and whatnot. You know, efficiency is really, you know, is almost like the go-to area. How can we be more efficient? You know, UPS drivers. I think somebody was telling me about a report where UPS was able, through, you know, efficient data analysis, shave something like 30 million miles off their drivers' routes in a recent year. I mean, don't quote me on that, you know, but that's the idea. So, you know, as a discretionary trader, you have to be left wondering, what could I be doing better? What's the optimal exit? You know, gee, maybe this pattern, this reversion pattern, this pullback would have been better entered, you know, a percent lower. You know, these are the kind of things that you just never are going to know as a discretionary trader. Whereas a quantitative trader, you can know, and then you have to, of course, be sensitive to, do you really believe in your back test? Is it significant? Is it statistically significant? So that, you know, that's another area of, there are a lot of pitfalls to become a quantitative trader if you don't do it right. But you know, that's the gist of it, in my opinion.
Okay, awesome. Thanks for breaking that down, David. So, what were some of the first steps you actually took in transitioning to a systematic sort of slash quantitative trader?
Right. The first step, I believe, was having a huge list of things I wanted to test. So, you know, as an often pattern-based trader, there were a lot of patterns, whether it was, you know, a technical, you know, triangle pattern, you know, symmetrical or ascending or descending. Obviously, I wanted to have conditions that surrounded that. So I just started, you know, obviously taking my discretionary approach and putting it into a list, which essentially were conditions. I mean, I don't think I would have called it that when I was creating that list, but I put these conditions in a list, and you know, and then I found somebody who was willing to help me code up just kind of like a master template, and that was invaluable. So that was really the, you know, the first foray was having somebody on the other side of the bridge code this up for me, you know, at a pretty reasonable rate, and you know, and then give it back to me, and, you know, with a couple notes, and then I was off, you know, and it was just a matter of you know, of starting to experiment, and I certainly did not have any great testing process at that point. I was smart enough to use out of sample data. That's a big thing. So I don't want to go all into, you know, those, you know, proper testing procedure, but you know, that's what I started to learn next. You know, apart from the coding, you know, I had a head start on the code itself, at least in that first program. But you know, from there, it was really, well, you know, what's, how many rules, you know, how many data points should I have? You know, how many rules do I have? Do I have too many rules over too little data? You know, these kinds of things you start to learn. And, you know, I started to read about trend followers, even though I'm equities, you know, one strategy is reversionary for the most part. Another strategy is quite varied. You know, futures trend followers are really some of the earliest systematic, programmatic, you know, quantitative traders. And I started really reading about them and reading about the turtles and, you know, really just the history of that early generation of systematic traders, many of whom, you know, could write their systems on the back of a napkin. you know, simple.
Okay, sure. So I don't know if this question may be sort of beyond the depth of this interview, but you mentioned earlier that you were sort of looking for your optimal exit, right? So what sort of process did you actually go through to discover the sort of the most optimal position to place stops for your actual trading method?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. It's a great question. And stops are one thing that, of course, as a discretionary trader trading larger concentrated positions, I found were getting in the way of some of the best edges. I started to, you know, create a bunch of edges, you know, a bunch of systems that, you know, most of which I did not ultimately keep, the best of which did end up in my, you know, in my meta system, which I still trade. But stops were something that when I traded a lot of positions with very small size, I got rid of, because often at least with my systems, the greatest probability of a reversion would happen essentially, at the stop point. So that's something that, you know, would be easier to see with some data. But in terms of how I determined optimal exits, you know, in forgetting about stops for a moment, just simply, let's say, a limit exit, or even, you know, any ways you could think of a swing style exit, whether it was, you know, end days later, end bars later, various exit styles based on indicators, you know, on and on, pattern based exits, and certainly I tested stop based exit too, trails and whatnot. But I would say the process of finding that optimal exit was really just testing all of them. And you find out early on, as you get into quantifying trading that and systems and edges and so forth, that you absolutely need to be incredibly organized with your record keeping of results, because you don't want to just constantly change indicator values, you know, and not keep track of what you're really learning. You're not going to learn enough as you combine multiple conditions together. If you don't understand each one separately and how it's starting to interrelate with the other, you know, you're going to be lost, you know, as you try to quantify. So it was really breaking down entries with a dumb exit, a so-called, you know, naive exit. I would, even in my code, I would call it dumb exit. You know, I would comment out, you know, some text that, you know, wouldn't be active code, but that's what they were called, dumb exits. So I would trade, you know, I would test entries over dumb exits. I would trade exits over random entries, you know, randomly generate an entry. Let's say, you know, day one has a bar in that low value and high value, you know, the whole range of that bar, any point on that bar, for instance, could be an entry, and that's a random entry test, or one iteration of a random entry test. So just basically, to be more simple in answering your question, you know, testing things separately, keeping good records, and finding out, at least based on the ideas that I was testing, what really was optimal. And it was typically a shorter hold time than I had anticipated. I had anticipated that actually with my approach, a longer hold time, you know, just some number of days more, was probably going to be a boon. You know, it was going to be superior. But actually shorter time, a hold time, was typically superior, you know, in my findings and, you know, in my approach. So it was illuminating. You know, it was very, some cherished notions tested well, other cherished notions had to be tossed into the fire.
Sure. That's really good, Dave. So now that you are sort of, you know, pretty much 100% a quantitative trader, what would you say this has allowed you to do that you couldn't do previously as a discretionary trader? Like, has it freed up sort of more time? Are there any sort of benefits in that regards?
There are a lot of benefits. I would say, yeah, time was not the first one that came to mind, but that is one. geometric sizing. You know, while I, as a discretionary trader, was familiar with position sizing and had written, you know, had read rather, you know, all the latest and greatest, you know, research and so forth, had built risk calcs and so on. I still did not feel like I was managing my capital, as efficiently as I could. Whereas once I was quantitative, I have, you know, a set of code for the signals. All aspects of the signals, you know, which I could go into deeply, but there's another set of code that's just the position sizing and risk management controls. So really being able to control these and study them ahead of risking dollar one with this new approach was fantastic. So I would say time is a benefit in the sense that, you know, I am not you know, the discretionary traders, you know, have that twofold job of, well, there's the during the daytime, you know, you're working during the daytime often, you know, even if you're not actively trading major decisions, you know, you're typically monitoring things, maybe looking for other things, you know, and then the market's closing, your day begins all over again with looking for opportunities and watch lists and alarms and on and on and on. So that process is incredibly streamlined now. Where it's really literally, you know, collecting more data and, you know, pressing some buttons and, you know, and then I have a flat file I can upload the next day or I can simply in another strategy, you know, simply deploy, you know, no order uploads necessary. It's going to be interactive throughout the day. So, you know, I'd say time is a benefit. Another benefit is risk, in the sense of being able to study all of these systems, you know, together. I do believe in multiple systems. You eliminate any single point of failure. That's crucial. So multiple systems together. You know, some people will say that is the you know, that is the one free lunch, you know, a form of diversification in the market. I was going to say about that. Basically, being able to study the interactions of those systems from a risk level. In other words, and you can do this as a discretionary trader as well. If you have enough historical trades, you can look at all your trades and you can input them into some Monte Carlo program. And essentially, Monte Carlo is going to give you alternate trade histories based on those trades, but randomizing them into a different order. And there are some versions of Monte Carlo where you can add substitutions that are statistically similar, you know, and there are all sorts of variations. But the bottom line is Monte Carlo analysis allows you to look at your strategy, whether it's real trades historically or hypothetical trades, and scramble them all up, look at alternate trade histories, and you see not one theoretical equity curve or one historical equity curve, but you see many. You can see, you know, 2,000, 2,500, 5,000, 10,000 if you want to go just absolutely nuts with the Monte Carlo. And you can learn a lot about your approach, and you can learn that, wow, you know, actually, let's say it's historical trades. I might have had a drawdown. This is just a hypothetical example. You know, I might have had a drawdown of, you know, 15%, you know, during the, you know, last X number of years I was trading the strategy. Well, you know, you do Monte Carlo, you might realize that you have actually a, you know, you have a 95% confidence of a 40% drawdown, you know, that you didn't know about, because a Monte Carlo analysis shows you that if your trades in the future are statistically similar to the trades in the past, then you might be assuming more risk than you knew about. So that's just a beautiful thing about quantifying trading, is that you can look at a risk level and you can say, okay, you know, what should my position sizing be? What should my approach be if I want my my max drawdown, my max expected drawdown to be no more than, let's say, 15%, you know, in all of those trade histories, you know, 100% confidence level, or you know, or 95% confidence level. So one in 20 years, you know, I might get a, you know, a drawdown that bad or possibly worse. I mean, so the benefits are so numerous. And, you know, quite frankly, I love data. This is already being called the decade of data, and we're only halfway through it. You know, when people came up with that term a couple years ago, at least, I'm sure, probably earlier than that. But, you know, this is an incredibly – I think this is the beginning. This is an incredibly fertile time in terms of data markets, data streams that are becoming standardized and usable as a trader. So I'm really glad that I did make that switch. It's not that there's any flaw with discretionary trading. I will still, like I said, occasionally make a discretionary trade, something that I don't have quantified perhaps, but I see the opportunity and it's very compelling and I like the risk. However, you know, there's just so much that I want to do, you know, in terms of quantification with financial data and, you know, and sentiment data and so on.
Yeah, there were so many good points that you brought up there, David, so that was really good. Obviously, a good system or a strategy is one that is robust. So how do you actually determine whether or not a strategy is robust?
Right. It's a great word. I would say that statistical significance is really the test that it must pass, you know, a high information ratio. You know, they're really metrics. So let me give an example of a couple. First of all, you know, there are some trading systems that people have, or you know, systems where I've seen in books, people write a book about trading systems, you know, and they'll include some systems, and you know, maybe they, you know, in a couple cases they'll have a system that they put out there, and it has, you know, it has a 100 trades historically, you know, it has a number of rules, you know, and there's no mention of statistical significance. That's important. There needs to be, in any good system, in my opinion, a lot of degrees of freedom. So in other words, the number of data points, number of trades, compared to the number of rules embedded in the system, all the conditions, all the decisions from entry to exit and so on, there have to be mostly degrees of freedom. There cannot be too many rules. So a robust system will be statistically significant at a very high confidence interval. You know, and there are programs that, you know, will enable you to you know, to do that within the software, or you can just do that within Excel. I mean, there are a lot of ways to do that. Certainly, there's plenty of literature on that. You know, another aspect to a good system, a robust system, is you know, there's so many. I would say ability to translate to other tradables. So you know, it should work across not necessarily a lot of asset classes. I'm not one who says that, you know, this equity strategy should work on, you know, on energy futures, you know, because there are a lot of structural differences, a lot of differences between the business of money management of equities and the institutional sponsorship and demand that can drive reversionary strategies in equities, whereas that doesn't exist in the same way in, you know, various commodity markets. But I do think, let's say within equities, a good system or a great system, a robust system, should work across most equities of the same class. You know, most you know, mega caps. You know, a strategy should be significant across them. You know, another aspect which might be too obscure, Aaron, so you can, you know, shut me up if you need to, but survivorship bias is something that the quantitative trader has to face. In other words, if you're developing an equity strategy across stocks, and you are testing across today's S&P 500 index components, you know, those 500 stocks that exist in the index today, and thinking that historically that's what you would have been trading. That is just not even close to the case. You know, where's Lehman Brothers? Well, it's not going to be in today's S&P 500. Where's Enron? It's not there. Where's WorldCom? You know, so you have to know as an equities quant trader, where are the tickers that live in infamy? You know, those are delisted. And so if you really want to go the extra mile, and in fact, there was a point, kind of another gut check point when I was developing, you know, one of my flagship strategy, one of my early, you know, meta systems, where I said, you know, what would Steve Jobs do? You know, like would he go, yeah, you know, it's time to build a survivorship bias free database, you know, because that's going to give me more information. And the answer, you know, in my head anyways, was, well, of course he would. You know, he's a perfectionist. He's going to want to know the absolute best approach to, you know, to building this product, this strategy, and therefore go the extra mile. And so, you know, that was one of those things I did, not from the very beginning. I developed a strategy, and then I said, you know what? I don't believe it enough until I add in the blowups. You know, I add in the Enrons and the WorldComs, you know, or the shorts that might have been taken over, acquired and gapped way up that aren't in the index anymore. So, you know, that's to me another real key for an equities trader to consider and hopefully test across are those delisted symbols. And I'll tell you, that's a real pain in the butt because you do, if you really going to do it to the daily level or even beyond, but certainly let's just say the daily level, you do need to know what are the constituents on any given day. You know, April 3rd, 1997, you know, if that was a business day, you know, what's in the index that day? Well, it might not be the same the next day. So that's quite a process to put something like that together, but I think worth it, and you know, yet another way to ensure that you have a robust system.
Yeah, again, that was a really good point you brought up there. I was actually going to ask you about survivorship bias, so yeah, that was good that you mentioned it. Have you ever come across a situation where sort of trading a particular strategy live perform nothing like the results it produced when going through your backtesting process?
You know, happily, the answer to that is mostly no. In fact, it's a more recent phenomenon of not having had that experience, happily, really having my performance live be what I expected in the from the back test. However, when I have altered execution, even after study, I have found that's an area where where the live results have not emulated the back test to the degree I like. So that's something that, you know, when I experience that, you know, I have to take that offline, revert back to, you know, the original, you know, proven methodology, you know, for execution, and then, and then go to the woodshed on what I was experiencing with, you know, with the change. So, you know, there can be some surprises like that. I'm certainly not immune to them, but happily, I took really 2 years to develop my strategy, which, you know, included, many systems together, the Stratversify strategy. And that, when I rolled that out, you know, it was really after about a 2 year process. I tried to see every facet of that diamond, if you will. And, once I rolled it out, I was happy with how it performed. You know, it brings up the point though of what How does one measure, you know, performance, you know, with a quantitative strategy? And, you know, that is something that, you know, traders will differ on in terms of, you know, how best to manage a strategy. Obviously depends on the strategy and the nature of the strategy. And it could be as simple as having sliding time windows for something like winning percentage. You know, if you see that your winning percentage is you know, dramatically different by some standard deviation from your expected winning percentage over a certain number of trades within a certain time window, you know, that could be something to examine. You know, so having some kind of dashboard, some kind of method at least for checking your system health, you know, that's important as a quantitative trader, rather than assuming, well, you know, hey, it's worked, so it's always going to work.
Yeah, too right. So that's really great. Another topic I'd like to bring up with you, and that is fractal patterns. Now, I don't know too much about fractals, but I believe it's something that might be relevant to your trading. So would you be able to explain this a little bit, sort of about what this is and how it's relevant?
Yeah, that's a huge question. It's a fun question. I am no fractal expert, you know, but I take inspiration from, you know, from those who are those experts. In fact, one of my favorite quotes is from the late mathematician Mandelbrot, who said that bottomless wonders spring from simple rules repeated without end. And, you know, I can imagine, I don't know actually the context in which he stated that, but I can imagine if it was a lecture that, you know, he was displaying, you know, his one of his fractal sets, or, you know, looking at a coastline, you know, and expanding, and it, you know, you go closer in on the coastline and it keeps getting longer. You cannot quite measure it because it just keeps growing, but nevertheless, the patterns are repeating almost on, you know, from any perspective, from any dimension. So certainly in trading, whether one's a discretionary or a quantitative trader, I mean, in fact, as a discretionary trader, you start to see that. You say, oh, well, look at this weekly pattern. Gosh, I've seen that on the daily charts before, you know, and then you look intraday and you say, well, gosh, here's that same pattern. You know, if I did not have, you know, date levels at the bottom of my chart, if I did not have, you know, year markers separating, you know, this year from that year on this large time frame, I might think this is an intraday chart. You know, so there is a definite widely recognized fractal nature to patterns, you know, in markets. And in terms of my own, you know, my own coding and so forth, that is something that is, you know, largely, it's a great interest to me. Lots of books on the subject. As you might tell, I love my trading books, and I try to read far outside of just trading, you know, which this would be one of those subjects that applies in so many fields, disciplines, and so on. But that's something that I am, you know, it's kind of in, I wouldn't even call it development phase. It's more the, you know, woodshed type of phrase. That's an expression from my music days. You know, if you hear some, you know, great musician playing something and you go, wow, you know, I cannot do that. What is that? You go lock yourself in the woodshed, you know, and you stay there until you figure it out. And then you methodically work on it over time till you get it. So, you know, fractals and incorporating fractals beyond my conceptual understanding and, you know, certain aspects, which maybe they're already, you know, coded to some degree, you know, that's something that's kind of in the woodshed. I do expect to, you know, maybe have a production strategy that is largely based primarily on you know, some fractal formulas as the key driver.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's a really good answer. So again, Dave, thanks very much. But now, I couldn't have you on without asking you about a quote that Zach Hurwitz mentioned on episode 11, which he learned directly from you. And that was the eagle, the donkey, and the mouse, or the concept of those three things.
Right.
So would you like to talk us through what this actually means and how you've used that to view trading?
Well, that's funny. I love Zach and certainly respect his his approach and unique ideas so much. In terms of that quote, it's funny. That is, I believe, from an older interview I did with the Tab Group, Quant Forum, and. I was probably speaking off the cuff. I'll tell you how I relate to that, though, which is certainly as a trader, or this could apply to anything, running a business. But certainly as a trader, I think you have to be all of these things, right? I mean, as a quantitative trader, for example, you have to have the vision. You have to have that perspective, that high, eagle-like vantage point where you're looking at markets and you bring some kind of concept, to, let's say, your coding. That is, in one sense, being the eagle, is having that vision of, what your strategy might look like. Or some concepts you're going to take to the woodshed, so to speak, and code up and see if they're really viable. The mouse, that the dollars in the details is an expression that I don't know if anyone else says, but I say it to myself all the time. Rather than the devil's in the details. As a trader, the dollars in the details. You got to be a mouse, and I mean you care. As a quantitative trader, anyways, about every period, comma, semicolon, forward slash, and so on that's in your code. It's all relevant. And if it's not relevant, then you're not a very elegant coder. But anyways, so you really do have to pay attention to the details. I would put, survivorship bias obsession with that and eliminating that from one's backtesting, I would put that in the mouse category, in the dollars and the details bucket, because it really does matter, what you're testing over. These kind of obsession with details also make you the donkey, because it's a lot of grueling work. I mean, it's easy to backtest poorly. We could talk about that for an hour. If you want to test well, you really do have to put in those hours that are, mentally backbreaking hours, if I can, use that phrase. And that's where the donkey comes in. So, probably using it a little bit differently than I did the first time and probably differently than Zach put it. But, that's how I relate to, to those roles. There's a lot of roles, whatever kind of trader you are. And, it's a demanding job, whether you're quant or whether you're discretionary.
Yeah, no doubt. That's really well said. So let me ask you this. What would you say to someone who is perhaps interested in adapting a quantitative approach with their trading, but maybe has little to no knowledge of actually how to code? So, I mean, is it fair and for good reason that many traders may find this daunting?
Yeah. Well, certainly I found it daunting. And I don't know if it would be easier today or not. I feel a little glib when I say I think it would be easier to cross that bridge today from a discretionary trader to a quantitative trader. And I think that is probably the case. There are so many even sites now that are giving you the opportunity to, have access to some very unique approaches to quantifying, financial data. So I do think it is easier today, but nevertheless, it is daunting because it's not something typically where you're going to dive in and you're just going to end up with something fabulous that is, just the optimal expression of everything you had hoped for, as a trader. But I would say that if you've traded – enough to have experienced pain as well as some success, even if you are, alternating, in those experiences, and you're essentially break even, but you do recognize, you have the ins and outs of the process of trading and so forth. You probably have an advantage over somebody becoming a quant with no concept of what the market is like, how behavioral it can be, and how driven by emotion it can be. So I don't know if that answers the question, but I would say that it's always going to be daunting. However, the tools today, they're out there, and you just have to go in with it, go into it with the attitude that this is going to be a process. This is not going to be something where, in a month I have my strategy. It's probably going to be some months of diving in. And last thing I'll say about that is, I've spoken to some, a specific example. I remember speaking to one young kid, real bright, who had just graduated from a pretty significant university with a recognized economics department, and he had quantified a strategy that that used weekly data and had no account in its risk or for anything that came between these weekly data points. So you can imagine what can happen in a week in, let's say, the equities market. A drop of 10 to 20% can happen inside that week. That doesn't even appear in the weekly data. If those kinds of dislocations are okay with you, you think you can continue trading them out, as they're happening, then maybe that's for you. But it does help to come to the quantification process, to the coding process, with some idea of how markets work, some experiences, rather than, in this kid's case, a real bright guy, but he hadn't experienced drawdown. He hadn't seen his savings, his account, his hard-earned money, whatever, start to evaporate intraday. And that's as I'm sure as any trader who's traded a number of trades knows, that's a formative experience. It's a gut check moment, and your insides become, it's like alchemy. Your insides, become made of different material after that happens. At least they're going to be if you're going to continue trading.
Yeah, for sure, Dave. So this has been incredible. So again, thanks so much for coming on. Let's just go to a couple sort of shorter questions, and then we'll start to wrap things up. So from what you've seen, what would you say sort of causes the majority of traders to never reach a high level of success that they sort of generally intend on reaching when they set out into trading?
Right. That's you have good questions, Aaron, not surprisingly. That is a great question. I would say that, we all come, or I'll certainly speak for myself. I imagine many other people are like this. We come to the market with these rose-colored glasses, right? I still remember looking at my father's TV and seeing the ticker tape, and this is like probably 21 years ago now. And I certainly went into markets thinking, wow, there's so much opportunity. Once you get, thrown down a staircase or two and you're hurting, you realize, wow, this risk part is pretty important. That was unfun. I do not want to live through that kind of trade or that experience or that drawdown or whatever again. So your lenses constantly change as you develop as a trader. And, some people are just going to say, I just don't want to dig that deep. It's too challenging. I'm going to have to look at my psychology or, my own belief system. I'm going to have to examine that. Come on, that's nothing to do with trading. But of course, It's everything to do with trading, especially as a discretionary trader, where you're more prone to succumbing to biases, and usually with larger positions. I would say that it's just a matter of digging deep. You know, I have met so many bright people. I work with some incredibly bright people, and I like, you know, I believe in fun, just like systems can diversify one strategy, you know, by being uncorrelated, for example, and removing a single point of failure. I like surrounding myself as much as possible with people who are brighter than me or think differently than me. And in this way, I'm getting exposed to, more ideas, more knowledge, more perspectives. My larger point with that is what, I guess, it's a matter of, of digging deep and constantly exposing yourself to new ways of thinking. And I think that's more than some people, you know, really are up for. To me, that's probably the number one reason. It's overcoming a lot of biases and taking a hard look in the mirror. You know, it can be rough in the early going, and it can be rough later on. But it, you know, in just as a trader, you know, there are bad periods for any approach, trader, strategy, what have you. But at that point, later on, you should be very well prepared for them, and you should know, especially as a quantitative trader, you know, am I in my risk parameters? Is this drawdown normal? On and on. So more than you asked for, probably. But I would say the digging deep, if I could put it in two words, that's what's required. Some people are going to leave it at a certain level and not, you know, push to be where maybe they could be.
Sure, yeah, those are some really great points. So now, as you mentioned, you're a big fan of reading a good book. So are there sort of maybe one or two books you'd maybe suggest as a good read for upcoming traders? Maybe one that it isn't even directly, you know, a typical sort of trading book.
Right. Yeah, boy, that is so that's so great. You know, I don't know if I can pick one. Let me just spit out, you know, a few. I thought that Fortune's Formula, it's not a trading book, but I found that to be fascinating and really helped drive me to want to quantify finally. So this is some years ago, but I found that to be excellent. I'm not a trend follower in the classic sense of that first generation trend follower, systematic trader, the turtles and so on, but I found that the book Trend Following by Michael Koval, you know, I found that to be fantastic. So many great anecdotes of the developers, you know, of the actual traders behind the system, so to speak. I thought that was a very well done book. I like that a lot. There are so many. You know, The Physics of Wall Street, that's a fantastic overview for someone who just is interested in the, you know, evolution of, you know, of really quantification largely, and some of the different players from different fields who have come into the field, of trading and so on. I could go on and on, but those come to mind off the top of my head.
Okay, sure. Yeah, those are excellent. So I'll be sure to put a link to those in the show notes. All right, Dave, well, we should probably wrap this up. I mean, I'm sure I could keep going on and on, but your answers have been unreal. So thanks again for going into so much depth with all of your answers. It's been awesome, and I've no doubt listeners are going to take a lot away from this interview.
Aaron, I sincerely appreciate it. It's great talking to you. I hope we can do it again.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.